This episode is brought to you by the Michigan Cherry Committee. Learn more about the wonderfully tart Montmorency cherry at choosecherries.com.
This week on Meetin' 3, we bring you stories about how Gen Z is different from their millennial predecessors through the lens of food.
My knowledge of alcohol didn't really come from like Bud Light commercials or like Project X.
Yeah, that's my gripe with the platform as well, is that all these DIY videos, cooking videos, they're 20 seconds.
What's one food item from your childhood that you wish you could have today?
Dunkaroos, because they don't exist anymore. Mm-hmm. Although, the Dunkaroos Twitter was activated again a year ago, so it's only a matter of time. They've tweeted a couple times, it's pretty hype.
Listen to Meetin' 3, HRN's food news and storytelling roundup, wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, this is Lisa Held, and you're listening to The Farm Report, a Heritage Radio Network show about the people, processes, and policies that shape how food is produced today. For today's episode, I'm sharing a recording of a recent online panel I moderated for the James Beard Foundation as part of a series of webinars related to COVID-19 and the food system in partnership with Civil Eats. In this conversation, you'll hear from farmers and other food leaders around the country about the things they've experienced in the months since the pandemic began. Black farmers losing markets for their produce in southern states, increased interest in local meat in Iowa, vegetable farms in New York moving their sales online, and so much more. You can find more conversations like this one and sign up to attend future webinars on COVID-19 and the food system at jamesbeard.org. This is also the last Farm Report episode of the summer season, so until September, stay safe. And just a reminder, there are many episodes in the archive to catch up on as our socially distanced reality drags on. Enjoy the episode.
Hello, everyone. My name is Colleen Vincent. I'm the VP of Community for the James Beard Foundation. Welcome to today's industry support webinar, COVID-19 and local food challenges and opportunities. Despite challenges like shuttered farm markets, farmers markets and restaurants, a shortage of meat processors and the scramble to move sales online, food producers are selling into local and regional markets and have demonstrated real resilience during COVID-19. In this panel, we'll explore how the pandemic has affected regional food systems in different areas around the country and what it means for the future. But first, we have some housekeeping notes. We ask everyone to please keep your questions to the end. There's a chat function, a question function in the box, and you can type it in there. After the broadcast has wrapped up, we will have a recording available that you can return to. So thank you again for joining us for today's webinar. Today will be moderated by senior policy reporter Lisa Elaine Held of Civil Eats. She covers the food system, agriculture, and the environment for many publications, and her stories have been published by EAR, The Washington Post, The New York Times, and Food and Wine. She also produces and hosts the weekly podcast, The Farm Report, on Heritage Radio Network. She is based in Baltimore and Washington, D.C. As for our panelists, first, we'll start with James Beard Leadership Award winner and Executive Director of the Federation of Southern Cooperatives, Cornelius Blanding, who began his career in development work as an economic development intern for the city of Miami Beach, and has since then gained a broad experience based, including rural, international, and cooperative economic development. In addition to serving as Executive Director of the Federation of Southern Cooperatives Land Assistance Fund, Cornelius has also served and continues to serve on various boards and committees, including the National Cooperative Business Association, Agricultural Safety and Health Council of America, Southeast Climate Consortium, and the Presbyterian Committee on the Self-Development of People. Our next panelist is Executive Director Dina Liebman from Future Harvest. Dina is the Executive Director of Future Harvest, the Chesapeake Alliance for Sustainable Agriculture, a nonprofit working to advance agriculture that sustains the farmers, environment, and communities of the Chesapeake region. Dina is also co-owner of the Zigbone Farm Retreat, a naturally built retreat and event space and 100-acre sheep and goat farm in Maryland's Cateton Mountains. Our next panelist is Lindsay Lusher-Schutt, CEO of Farm Generations Cooperative, also a farmer and co-owner of Hardy Roots Community Farm. Lindsay is the founder of the Farm Generations Cooperative, a national initiative to expand the market share and viability of small farmers with fair farm-owned technology. Before Farm Generations, Lindsay co-founded the National Young Farmers Coalition and led the organization in its first decade. She has authored 9 policy reports for the coalition, and under her tenure, the organization launched state and national campaigns on affordable farmland. She was recognized as a champion of change by President Barack Obama, and is the recipient of the Glenwoods Harvest Award. Eating Well magazine named Lindsay an American food hero, and she's among the 20 food leaders under 40 by FoodTech. Wendy Johnson is our next panelist. She's the farmer and owner of Joya Food Farm and farmer manager of Centerview Farms. She and her husband own and operate Joya Food Farm, a diverse livestock and organic grain farm located in Northeast Iowa. They raise and sell meat and eggs direct to consumer through buying clubs and their e-commerce platform. She also works as a farm manager for her family's conventional grain farm, which she is trying to infiltrate by adding crop, livestock, and habitat diversity slowly but surely. And so I am very pleased to turn our panel over to our moderator, Lisa Elaine Held of Civil Eats. Thank you, Lisa.
Thank you so much, and thank you all for joining us today. I'm thrilled to be moderating this second webinar in the series hosted by Civil Eats and the James Beard Foundation. And my colleague, Nadra Niddle, moderated the first one, which was on race and food during COVID-19. And I wanted to start by saying, if you missed it, I really encourage you to watch the recording of that one. But today we're going to be talking about local food. So Civil Eats has for a very long time closely covered local and regional food systems, from small farms that offer CSAs and sell at markets and directly to restaurants, to local processors and food hubs that distribute regionally. And since the start of the COVID-19 pandemic, these systems have been in the spotlight more than ever before. We've been watching what we cover all the time get covered by every publication and really get more attention. And, you know, as coronavirus outbreaks hit grocery stores and the biggest meatpacking plants, many people who had not thought of buying local before signed up for CSAs or purchased local grass-fed beef. But producers have at the same time faced incredible challenges in terms of operating during a pandemic and losses due to restaurant closures. And I've been reporting on all of this since March, talking to farmers, professors, policy experts all over the country. And I think the thing that's most interesting to me is that depending on who you talk to, COVID-19 is either sounding the death knell for local food or introducing a modern day renaissance. So there's a lot to dig into. And with this panel, we're gonna try to get to the bottom of what the future looks like. So I thought we would start with Wendy. Wendy, one of the reasons local food has gotten so much attention is that the sort of counterpart, the commodity food system, has really been disrupted, and Iowa is at the center of that. You know, the meatpacking plants and rural communities where they're located have been particularly hard hit by COVID-19. You know, workers have been getting sick. Commodity pig farmers have been trucking animals all over the country because of processing backups. It's just, there's a lot of attention on kind of the failure of that side of the system. And you are in Iowa and you also operate a small organic farm there. So tell us what it's been like for you during this time.
Well, it's been really interesting. We've seen definitely the fragility of our food system, and what we initially saw in the beginning when there were food shortages in the grocery stores was some panic buying, which I'm sure happened all across the U.S. But it's very interesting in Iowa because we have so many meatpacking plants here. We raise so many hogs and chickens and turkeys and eggs in Iowa. And to see that loss of fresh meat in the meat cases in the grocery stores was shocking to a lot of people. And so I think a lot of people panicked and they went directly to local farms to see if they could either buy in bulk or purchase whole animals and purchase many of them at a time, or go in with another family. People were starting to get creative in terms of going with half or quarters or shares on different animals. And so we saw that initially as because we have an e-commerce site, we kind of moved into it very fluidly, and our sales did increase for quite some time. And because of kind of this panic of not being able to see the meats in their grocery stores. As you said earlier, we have buying clubs, which have been quite successful for us. But we also like to diversify our market, our marketing, and that include aggregation and retailers and restaurants. And it's kind of interesting to see how the buying clubs really increased in numbers during that time. And obviously the restaurants and the retailers suffered a little bit. Those numbers went down. Now they're kind of balancing out. But we also offered, starting a few years ago, we offered a CSA or a meat subscription. And we saw those numbers really increase in customers because people wanted this consistent meat product delivered to them.
Right. And did you see any challenges with getting your animals processed? Because I know I've reported a lot on the fact that small processors have been overloaded because of the slowdowns with the bigger plants not being able to, the inventory moving to the smaller plants and then everybody wanting more local meat. What has that been like for you?
So we luckily had our date set for May, June, and July usually in a normal year, you have to make your appointments about 6 months in advance. So we had those appointments. So we were able to really be able to supply. That doesn't solve our problem of our future supply. And right now dates in most processes are backed up until the early 2022s that year. And so we are really dependent on the relationship that we've created with our processors. And hoping they will fit us in places where here and there, that's the most important thing. I have heard that there are processors in Iowa. These are smaller processors, state inspected usually. Some are only taking wholesale or retail animals. They're not doing the custom processing, kind of leaving the custom processors to do just the custom. And here in Iowa, we'll see deer processing coming up pretty soon here in the fall. And that also, we're wondering, what is that going to look like and how is that all going to work? We definitely are short processors in Iowa, small scale processors, but we hope the interstate shipment program just passed here in Iowa and that state inspected processing plants can ship, or they can put a USDA stamp onto products, which will really help a lot of the direct marketers here in Iowa.
Wendy mentioned e-commerce, and Lindsay, I think that makes sense to go to you to talk a little bit about that. One thing that we've heard a lot from small farms is that in response to the pandemic, they have shifted all of their sales online. And you had created this online sales platform for farmers, and I don't know, was it not ready? It was ready, but you basically kind of had it catapulted into use by COVID. Tell us a little bit about that.
That's right. So the Farm Generations Cooperative is a cooperative of growers nationally that is building fair technology for farmers, and the first project, this entire cooperative was incubated by the National Young Farmers Coalition, while I was there, we received some USDA funding to build this platform for direct market sales, because we saw over the last 5 to 10 years, more software coming online that outside of COVID, more consumers are wanting to purchase food online. Like that's a trend that was already in motion. COVID has sped that up significantly, but we saw issues with the current software that was available and the fact that none of those platforms were cooperatively owned. So that introduces a significant amount of risk for farmers who are putting all of their pricing data on that platform, all of their customers. They have very little leverage when it comes to influencing the price of a given piece of software or how their data is going to be used. And we have stories of farmers that ran into issues with that. So we decided to build a platform that would, in fact, facilitate sales between consumers and farmers. We built a version of that and intended to launch it. The platform is called GrownBy. It will be an app that will be widely available in the fall. The intention was to test it in beta form this spring. And then COVID struck and we were like, okay, we need to expand the beta. So in fact, we took on 18 farms this season using GrownBy, many of whom lost their farmers market. And essentially what GrownBy does is enables a farm to put up their products online, to sell like a CSA share through a subscription. And eventually it'll be able to do a lot more than that, help to manage those sales, help to do pre-order. My farm, Hardy Roots Farm, one of the significant shifts for us was that we have a farm store on site. We opened a couple of years ago, usually just breaks even. Like it's more of a, I don't know, I called it like a community endeavor just because we wanted to be able to open our front door to our community. Normally we sell most things through subscription. Not everybody's familiar with that. We ship a lot of product down to New York City, but the farm store just, the sales growth was pretty incredible. We in fact closed the store, made that into a warehouse for our products and regional products around us from local farms, and did a lot of pre-ordering too. So it wasn't just CSA, but also consumers wanting to fill a grocery basket in advance and then have an order ready in a box that they could pick up with no contact. So yes, technology is incredibly important in this moment. It's important that we have technology that is able to speak to the complexity of direct farm sales. Mandy was talking about like the availability of meat. We're not like a grocery store at our farm store. We don't have product all the time. It just varies. And so what we're trying to do with GrownBy and we're modeling is how can we just make that interaction between a farmer who is limited, has this incredible product available, but not in the same way you would expect with a grocery store purchase, and the consumer. So yep, it'll be available this fall. And right now we're in the process of talking to farmers about their experience with a tech that they have used outside of GrownBy this season, and are hopefully going to be able to solve a lot of the challenges that have arisen. But I think overall, the food system has changed. Like these buying habits, whether it's buying from a farm on a subscription basis or just purchasing food online, I think a lot of those things are going to stick, and certainly how farms are presenting themselves online and presenting their products. I think that technology is going to be a fundamental piece going forward, even more so than it was before this COVID crisis occurred.
Yeah, I want to get more into that. I think I definitely want to hear what everyone has to say about sort of the future and where these challenges become opportunities. So let's put a pin in that. Cornelius, I wanted to hear from you. You work with a network of farms and co-ops in the South that primarily is made up of Black farmers. What have you seen in terms of the challenges the farmers in your network are facing? Do they look like some of the challenges Wendy and Lindsay are talking about? What have you been seeing?
Yeah, well, thanks for the question. Very much so. So the Federation is a cooperative association of Black farmers, landowners, and cooperatives all around the South. We primarily work in about 9 Southern states, deep South states. We have offices, physical offices, staff, and membership concentrated all around the Deep South. Because we're working primarily with limited resource farmers, landowners, and cooperatives, we have to deal with a number of issues. Many of these are agricultural co-ops, but some are not. And in their communities, we're dealing with everything from housing to access to credit to the issues on the farm. So we've seen many of those issues that have been discussed already. But one of the other things, we always have to gear up for disasters. And right now we're speaking about COVID-19. But as an organization, we had to do the exact same things after Katrina, after some of the tornadoes that tear through the South, and now COVID-19. But what we normally do right after any disaster, we do an assessment of our membership. And maybe 2-3 weeks after the pandemic and after people started doing the shut-in orders, we did an assessment of about 200 of our members, 200 Black farmers. 2 or 3 weeks later, we added about 100 more assessments to that surveys where we were asking specific questions to make sure that the data that we had didn't change over the weeks. And roughly about 82% of those people said they have been affected, their markets have been impacted. Because when you're talking about small limited resource farmers, our farmers specifically, they're selling directly to some of these restaurants. And they lost those markets. Many of the farmers' markets closed down. So about 82% of them said they were affected by this COVID disaster relief. That was directly. But you had, and then you had about 75% who didn't even know some of the disaster assistance relief was out there. So as an organization, what we were doing is really trying to make sure we got the information out, but got it out in the environment where you had this disaster where nobody could move around. So now you're talking about an organization that spread out around the South with physical staff and locations that used to doing direct hands-on work, has to now resort to telephones and Zoom calls, and the Zoom calls were very limited to us. Unfortunately, my office is in Atlanta, so we have a lot better access, but many of our field offices, all of our field offices are in rural areas. They don't have access to broadband. Some of them don't even have internet access. So we have to be creative around those things. So our challenge was trying to figure out how do we connect to a membership of limited resource farmers and cooperatives during a pandemic and make sure that they, one, knew about the resources that were out there, and then how do they start accessing them, how do they start utilizing them, and in the sense of this, not only were they impacted in terms of their farms, many of those communities now were shut off and didn't have access to food. And so the way we've always looked at this is that farmers have been the first responders in our communities, and particularly these communities, these farms, even though they're limited resource growers, they're the anchors of their communities in these communities that we're talking about. And so really trying to address this from multiple areas. But again, what we know is that about 82% of them were directly impacted by this.
Yeah, and you know, you just mentioned there's sort of two crises, which is, you know, farmers are challenged in terms of markets, and then also there's been a huge rise in food insecurity. And one of the things that the Federation has done was you got a grant to do the USDA Farm to Families Food Box Program. And this is a really interesting example to me because that program has almost exclusively been in the news as a disaster. They kind of gave up a lot of money and there was a lot of missteps and who got the funds and, you know, was it being used in the right way? And your organization got the grant and seemed to just immediately be distributing tons of farm fresh food to a lot of people. Can you talk a little bit about why, like how you were able to so quickly mobilize farmers and the network to make that work?
Yes. And you're absolutely right. There are two faces to this program. And we understand all the challenges that are involved. One, when this pandemic is new to all of us, and so here you are having a government trying to really ramp up resources and get them out to do something. And, you know, there's different views around all of this. But we felt the challenge in this as well. You know, one, in order to put in the application for these agreements around this food box program, you had something like 5 to 7 day turnaround. And so that's extremely difficult within itself, trying to get the amount of information that was being asked as part of this program to get all that kind of information together, get it in, and validate things in a short turnaround. Two, again, not many people, including the government, USDA, knew much about what was going on and what they really needed. So we were operating in that environment. And so I see it's a huge challenge for many others who might be interested in or might be better suited or in positions to actually distribute food to these communities. And so you had a lot of folks who couldn't access it. Fortunately, we could, but we're a 53-year-old organization. We're a 53-year-old organization with offices and staff around all around the South, with folks who are on the ground working directly with our membership, the membership who own and control the organization. And regional marketing is something that we've known has been a critical part of what we do from the beginning. As a matter of fact, our organizations and the cooperatives that make up our organization were formed out of necessity. We were formed in the 1960s during turbulent times. So Black farmers didn't have any option but to figure out systems that worked within a system in order to survive. Those were the 22 co-ops that created the Federation. They came out of necessity and they formed the Federation out of necessity. And one thing that's been clear to us is that we spend every hour of our days working on land retention issues, making sure that Black farmers maintain their land base in a system that's constantly trying to take it. We spend all of our time making sure that farmers and co-ops have access to markets when there aren't any or when they're very inequitable. And so those things are what we've done historically over 53 years. And so we were set up to do that. It wasn't a big transition for us to say, look, we're already set up to do this. And again, I mentioned to you, for us, farmers are the first responders, because when Katrina hit, those tornadoes hit, our communities don't get fed unless those farmers provide that food. And it's no different with this food, with this pandemic. So the food box program, when it was announced, we already had converted our training center over to a distribution site with one of the food pantries where the communities were coming in getting food from our training center. We had already converted one of our co-ops over to a facility where we could get food down to a farmer's market in New Orleans where people could drive up. So it was an easy transition for us. But again, because of our history, because of our pain also. And so, but I do see the challenges with others. But this food box program by no means is perfect. This pandemic isn't perfect. But we have been figuring out how to navigate the challenges around it to do what's most important and what I hope the food box program is set up. And that's to reimagine our food system, to really look at it from a local perspective and make sure that we build it out from a local and regional perspective, as opposed to depending on, as Wendy mentioned, some of these processors who are large processors who were forced to close down and weren't able to process things. We dealt with that issue also. Some of the folks who we're working with around meat, we had to scale back our program because we could no longer deliver meat because we couldn't get it processed. So those are the challenges. But the opportunities are, how do we rebuild this system? How do we make sure that we build some local infrastructure that's owned by people in the communities, and that we recognize farmers and communities as the ones who are really on the ground supporting and responding to their community needs, even in times of disaster. At this point, we've delivered about 12,000 boxes, I think, of produce, each box being about 25 pounds of food. And we've just delivered them through systems and through partnerships we already had set up with many of the Black churches, with food pantries, with other nonprofit organizations who are already working with communities who were in need. And those folks are in need because of this pandemic, but they were in need before this pandemic as well. So these systems are extremely important. This pandemic has shed a light on some of the inequities in the country and shown that, hey, there are a lot of needs out there because of this pandemic, but there are a lot of needs out there that existed before the pandemic. And we have to figure out the best way to address them and address them from a food perspective. And so this conversation is timely. I thank Silver Leaps and the James Beard Foundation for having them. We got to continue to have them, but we got to really be very intentional about what we do after this. How do we rebuild? And so looking at this food box program and all that it is and isn't, and figuring out where do we go from here and how do we use it as a stepping stone.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. And Dina, you've also been kind of responding to the needs of a community of farmers, just a different community, which is the farmers in the Mid-Atlantic. Can you talk a little bit about the challenges that you noticed right away when COVID-19 emerged that farmers were facing, and some of the ways that Future Harvest has jumped in to help those farmers?
Sure. you know, it's only like 4.5 months ago, but it seems like it was years and years ago that the pandemic started. But at the very beginning, the anxiety was just palpable in our community of farmers, which are mostly diversified fruit and vegetable farmers, some grain farmers in the Chesapeake region. And at that time, you know, this was brand new to everybody in the world. And nobody knew how to keep themselves, their workers, and their customers safe. And at the same time, demand was spiking. That's what we've seen a lot of for our farmers, is that the demand just went, just skyrocketed at the beginning of the pandemic. And so this all led to all manner of pivoting, which I think is the word of the year. Farmers had to scramble to adapt, and so did Future Harvest. We're a 21-year-old organization that has worked to advance sustainable agriculture in the Chesapeake region. So the first thing we did was we created a find a farmer map, because as the other panelists have mentioned, consumers, they were walking into grocery stores, shelves were empty, and there was this sense of panic. I felt it a little bit myself. So we created this map. We have 670 listings on it, and we've had about 160,000 views as of today. I hadn't checked in a while, and the link to it will be in the chat box. The second thing we did is it does seem so long ago. We learned everything we could about the virus. And in those days, those early days, it was all about surface contamination, not about respiratory transmission. And so it was a lot about packaging and gloves and how to put your gloves on and off. And anyway, we developed safety protocols for farmers markets, and we held webinars on food safety protocols, mainly in the pack stations, and then also at the markets. We held a community COVID call, which Cornelius, that was sort of our cheap and easy way of doing a survey. We just had everybody pile onto a call, and we had some farmers leading it and just talking about what they were dealing with. And, you know, everybody was going all online. They, again, new packaging regimes. There were collaborations starting up for home deliveries. We saw an uptick in interest in cooperatives, especially on the part of farmers of color. A lot of pooling of resources. At the same time all this was happening, we saw that, you know, like everybody in the world did, the lines of feeding into the food banks, and farmers not being able to get their food to the food banks. So we started a mini grant campaign called Feed the Need. We raised about $50,000 that we're paying out to farmers this month to contribute their produce to food banks or any farmers' families in need, whatever they see fit. We got $250,000 worth in funding requests. So we're still raising money. Again, a link in the chat if you want to donate. We moved all our programming online, our field schools, all our farmer-to-farmer education, beginner farmer training program. The annual conference is going to be awesome, but it's also going to be virtual. And I just have to hand it to small and mid-scale diversified fruit, vegetable, meat, and dairy farmers. They were nimble. They were collaborative. They rose to the occasion, and they kept our communities fed in those early days. And I just have to hand it to them. It was great. So I'm very proud of our community. And to sort of echo what all the other panelists are saying, this pandemic is shining a light on challenges. There's a lot of uncertainty, but it's also providing a real opening for many opportunities. And so we're about to launch a project called the RCR project, Resilient Crisis Ready Chesapeake Food System. And it's going to start, Cornelius, with a survey on getting people's ideas, just a big brain dump on what they think we need to do to ensure that our food system is never in a weak and vulnerable position again. How do we strengthen our local and regional food system? What does that take? Anything from emergency seed banks. We had a run on seeds. Farmers couldn't get seeds. Any number of things, local procurement standards. But if you're going to ask about policy, I can go into all that later. So,
go ahead.
We're seizing this as an opportunity as well as a difficult time.
This episode is brought to you by the Michigan Cherry Committee. A cherry isn't just a cherry. When it comes to tart cherries, the wonderfully U.S.-grown Montmorency tart cherry variety is the cherry with more. They're available year-round, dried, frozen, canned, juice, and concentrate. U.S. Montmorency tart cherries are also one of America's superfruit, which means they're good for you. Tart cherries contain many antioxidants and beneficial phytonutrients, including anthocyanins, the pigments that give tart cherries their beautiful red color. And don't forget about flavor. U.S. Montmorency's unique sour-sweet profile makes them an excellent addition to yogurt, oatmeal, salads, trail mix, and of course, a classic cherry pie. Learn more about the wonderfully U.S.-grown Montmorency tart cherry at choosecherries.com.
I'd actually love to hear everyone, if you'd all like to kind of weigh in on this question. I mean, Cornelius, you made this point that this is one disaster, right? And there have been many other disasters faced by farmers. And we're also still, standing in the middle or at the precipice of a major disaster, which is the climate crisis, and thinking about that, right, while we're in this other one. And I think, I would love to hear from you. You've all kind of like scratched the surface, but I'd love to get more into what do you feel like we learned about local food, small farms, regional food systems from this period and making it through this pandemic day by day? What have we learned about how to feed ourselves and how to have a more sustainable, resilient food system in the future?
I think consumers have learned a lot. I'll say that much. I mean, we're kind of like, this is what we've been part of this system. We know it well. It's been the first time where I have felt as a farmer truly essential. I've always known that I was essential, right? Like, but now our neighbors, right? Wow, we can't believe. We are so grateful that you are here. You make me feel secure because you're here in my community growing food that I can go and buy. So I think that has been a significant shift just in from the consumer's vantage point. If they have no idea where their food comes from and it's not showing up where they expected in the grocery store, suddenly they're looking outside and saying, who else in the community is here to provide? So that has really been a reckoning in the consumer community, which is very exciting. I mean, I think this is also laid bare just economic insecurity in the United States in such a huge way. And the food system is where you see that first, like the lines to food banks, like the inability of a highly consolidated food system to quickly pivot, to serve that need, to serve all of the needs. It has just made hopefully everyone aware of the degree of risk that we have in a system without small and local agriculture. It is absolutely essential. And I'm hopeful that coming out of this, people will realize that and we can actually get behind some system change to really support all of the growers that we're working with.
Wendy, I'm curious to hear if you also are seeing the same thing as Lindsay in terms of, are people thinking differently about their food choices, and do you think that that is something that will continue?
This is a great question because I'm part of a broader network of farmers here through Practical Farmers of Iowa, and what we've been hearing with our large network of direct-to-consumer farmers and ranchers are, one, they've created some different strategies and solutions to marketing, and the CSAs that had a resurgence, and where they, in the past year or so, they've been dying. And so I question what is going to happen when those, let's say, the vegetable CSAs end in the fall, right? And our meat processing is having a hiccup because we can't get our animals into the processors in a timely way. And on our farm, we're seeing a slight decline in sales from its peak in April and May and the early parts of June. And we're wondering, and amongst a PFI network, some other farmers are having a similar situation. One farmer that does a lot of their marketing into the suburbs of Chicago at the peak saw, he did, in 1 month, he did sales that he would do in 3 months within the month of May. And now he's also seeing a decline in sales. And so how can we get, as farmers and organizations, how can we get this to stick? How can we get local food and the importance, the essential, we are essential, how can we continue that? And here in Iowa, I'm questioning, our farmers are questioning, how can we make it stick? And I think it comes to, I think you're gonna touch on this later, Lisa, on a federal and state level, and we're gonna talk about policy. When it comes to that, I think that will help. Federal subsidies are in the, I think, in the wrong place, for one. And food is very undervalued here in the U.S. And when grocery stores started to get filled and stocked up again, it's very easy for consumers to just move back into that, into those habits of buying at the store.
Right. Yeah. Well, what are some of the policy solutions that you all are thinking about? Let's just get into that.
I raised my hand. So we've been thinking a lot about this with the RCR project. So a bill passed unanimously in Maryland requiring state institutions to source 20% of the food in their food service areas locally or regionally. Again, passed unanimously. It was vetoed by Governor Hogan. It's going to come up again in the next session, and they expect to override the veto. And when that happens, that's going to be a big market. It's a wholesale market, not top dollar, but it's going to be a big market. I think that kind of policy has to be put in place across the nation, keeping these markets strong. And you can't just rely on consumer behavior. And we have to do some true cost accounting of the true cost of producing food in mass-produced ways, importing them into regions that are perfectly capable of growing their own food. The environmental bill that's attached to that kind of agriculture is high, but it's over here, right? So it's not counted. Whereas the cost of production for a direct-to-consumer farmer, all the costs are right into that cost, and that's why it costs more. So I could go on. I'll let other people speak. I have lots of other policy ideas, but I think those are important.
This is a huge this is a huge conversation. I know we don't have time for all of it. I agree with everything that's been said, Lindsay, in terms of hoping consumers really stay with where we're going. I doubt it because the first, you know, even in terms of this pandemic, you see what grocery stores, in order to get consumers in, and rightfully so, they have began to lower prices because so many people are hurting economically out there. But when they lower those prices, somebody else bears the brunt of that, to what Dina's saying. This is an issue around parity. And so we have to have those conversations that we've been scared to have. We got to have them in the future when all this is over, hopefully. But we also got to look at some other things, because there's some other things at the source of this. Because in our communities and black with black farmers, you're struggling with land access and land tenure. And so we're working on things around heirs property laws to make sure that you can maintain a land base in these communities, because when the land's lost, it doesn't stay in agriculture. And if we don't realize the value of food, we should now. In order to have that food, you gotta have farmers. In order to have, you gotta have land. And so we gotta tighten up laws around that to help secure the land base, even and especially in these black communities, because we are a significant part of the farming population and should be. It's a benefit to the country, but also some of the other underlying issues around debt and around credit access. And so one of the major things that we're working on with a network of other farm organizations is really trying to create a black farmer financial institution, something, because at the end, the largest lawsuit in this country where USDA admitted discrimination among black farmers, where black farmers couldn't get access to credit. And you're talking about a lawsuit that cost this country over $2 billion. That, now, what do you do to make sure this doesn't happen again? Because money was paid out, but systems weren't changed. And so you got a lot of people that were left with debt, and debt is going to run them out of farming. It's going to change the landscape of our communities if we don't deal with it. And we got access to credit in the future. So a lot of the advocacy work that we're working on deals with things around that nature, around land access, around debt forgiveness, and around credit.
Absolutely. I think I kind of want to just circle back to, I think you all kind of said you're hopeful that the pandemic will lead to people making different choices, but that you're doubtful that it will. I think almost everybody said that. And I guess I wanted to circle back to that before we finish, because I don't think we've really landed on, like, is there a message for eaters, chefs, just people who aren't the producers of food, that is coming from this pandemic that you want to get across about the resilience of local food systems? Like, if you could talk to people about, like, why this should kind of make you think about local food, what kind of argument would you make about what this pandemic has demonstrated and the resilience of local food?
Well, you've seen these, for one thing, you've seen these huge shifts. You've seen these small producers who, on, you know, one day they think they've maybe lost their entire market because they were completely dependent on restaurants. But then a couple weeks later, they could actually shift because they were small enough and they had enough community connections to pick up the phone and say, can I sell at your market? Can I join your CSA? We've just seen some amazing relationships and new collaborations and partnerships come out of this that are only possible when you have a regional relationship-based food system. Like Cornelia, like the Federation of Southern Cooperatives is a perfect example of that. You've been around for 50 years, families and businesses that have been tied together in a way that presents such strength and resilience in a moment of crisis. So, I mean, I think that, people are going to see lower prices at the grocery store, and some are going to need to take advantage of that given what's happening with jobs, with unknowns, with unemployment. I mean, there's so many variables that are going to require that some consumers need to do what they can in this moment. But I think hopefully for many people, they're going to think about, what does this place mean to me? And I want to support my community and these farms that are here and are going to be here no matter what's around the corner. So hopefully that's going to translate into leaders and lawmakers who also understand that and will take action to make sure that we're not going to lose all of our farmland to development or to you know, more consolidated operations or whatnot. We are going to really prioritize small and local food systems and farmers and resiliency in the future.
But I gotta say, I agree, but I wouldn't wanna rely completely on raised consumer awareness. I really, really think that this is an opening for real policy shifts. For Black farmers, because you cannot have a resilient, crisis-ready food system without equity. For procurement standards, for shifting, as Wendy said, shifting federal subsidy programs from large commodity to small to mid-scale agriculture, which benefits from very little subsidies. I mean, our farmers won't apply for crop insurance because it's just so much paperwork for not much gain. And yet they feed a whole section of their community. And it's so direct, it makes no sense. So I would combine the free market consumer raised awareness with a strong legislative policy push that ensures that our food systems are never, ever again in this vulnerable position.
I agree also, and I'm gonna echo what has been said. We have to look at this from the food system perspective and make sure people understand that we are all a part of the system. And we talk about the food system, we're not just talking about farmers. We're talking about from the producer all the way to the consumer. And those chefs that you brought up, Lisa, they are very much a part of this. They're preparing the food, and I think they have a lot of influence on folks that come to these restaurants and beyond. And I think we have to use all that influence for the things that Dina and Wendy mentioned in terms of really how do we allocate or reallocate resources. We have to realize, we should realize after this pandemic, that farming is a public service. Yes, there need to be low priced food in this country for folks who can't afford it. But when there is that situation, it can be subsidized. When we start realizing that farmers are public servants and that food is mandatory, because again, we look at them that these farmers have been and they're still the first responders. And how do you support your first responders? You have to. And so I think when we all realize that and we realize it from a food system perspective, where all of us are adding to it, whereas the producers talking about it, the consumers talking about it, but also the chefs talking about it and those distributors, everybody talking about it and realizing that this is a public service, that we have to have food and our food system is fragile. And it was shown during this pandemic and it's shown every time a disaster comes, but it's always saved by those folks who bear the biggest burden, those small farms and landowners. And it's about time that we start supporting them and putting legislation in place that really builds on that. But it comes from a simple concept of realizing that these farmers are providing a public service.
And I agree with all that as well. And I'd just like to add also health insurance. As farmers are essential workers, just having health insurance so that two farmers can stay on the farm versus, you know, one, and one has to have a job in town. Again, reiterating, local food is not a luxury. It's a necessity, and that farmers like myself, we were able to be really nimble and kind of slide in without a hiccup. We were able to help in these situations, and just creating that support for these kinds of for small and mid-sized farms is so important. Networking is also a huge thing, and I know a lot of the organizations here are represented are working with networks of farmers, but that whole networking, community building, regional food system building is—it's all together. It's all one, and those are really important for small and mid-sized farmers. And also, I think that we need more infrastructure. There's infrastructure there in place for the big commodity farms, the commodities, but there isn't for yet for local food systems. And That includes processing, not just meat processing, but vegetable processing and aggregation and these delivery systems. Those are all things that we need as local and mid-sized farms as to help us grow.
I love that you brought up infrastructure because it's a really nerdy thing that nobody ever talks about, right? It's the core of food systems, but it never gets talked about. You know, growing the food gets talked about. But I think we're about to wrap up, but I think what a cool place to end because it's this thing that never comes up. So just want to put out to everyone before we wrap up, is there specific infrastructure that you think could be fixed, added on to, really revved up in order to support local food? Like if you could choose a piece of infrastructure to really improve for local food systems, what would it be?
Cold storage.
I would definitely echo that, but as Wendy mentioned, the local processing and distribution channels. We found dealing with these food box programs, it's hard to get transportation in when you're talking about moving from a farmer to a nonprofit, moving small places in the community. Nobody can do that. And so really having access to that infrastructure that both have mentioned here, that Wendy and Dean have mentioned, but also transportation in there. But at the heart of it, it has to be owned by those farmers and their communities. Make it local. Otherwise, that you put it at the risk of everything else.
Well, I'm going to say technology. because that's what we're working on, and it's critical with all of these other things. But we have to reach consumers. We have to reach them more effectively. We have to bring them in. We have to really be competitive where consumers are as a community. So all of the above, and we need to modernize these systems. We need to be in this new food market place, wherever it's going.
Wendy, did you want to add something?
Because I'm in the meat business, I just want to add these expanding current meat processing plants in Iowa, these smaller custom processors, supporting them or being able to expand those businesses would be really helpful. I think Will Harris said one time that every state in the U.S. should have a mid-sized processing plant, that's somewhere in the middle. Not really small, not really big, but that can support a number of farmers and their processing needs. But also the expansion of some of these smaller units, which are scattered across every state, that support is really needed.
Wendy, that's so funny that you said that because I interviewed Will Harris once, and that it's the same. He said a similar thing to me that really stuck with me, which is he said, my farm is not scalable, but it is replicatable, which, you know, there could be a, you know, incredible, all these small farms all over the country and systems that support them. Well, thank you all so much. This was an incredible discussion, and thank you all for joining us.
Pleasure.
Thank you. Thank you everyone so much for being here. Please have an awesome rest of your day. Thank you so much to our panelists for such an incredibly robust discussion. And please check out the virtual events tab on the James Beard Foundation website if you'd like to go to more webinars like this one. So have a great day, everyone.
Thank you all so much for listening to the Farm Report on Heritage Radio Network. If you enjoyed the conversation, please subscribe to the podcast, rate it, and share it. We'll be back in the fall. The Farm Report is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Just enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org.
Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.